When we are in this chapter, we were from volume 16. You see, we discussed in our last class more or less this common understanding of the concept of rebirth, which is really based on the notion of God as a dispenser of rewards and punishments. As he puts it here, that we suffer for our sins in another body and we shall be rewarded in another body for our virtues in this. And so it will go on ad infinitum. So we discussed these questions of moral attitude and, you know, which Aurobindo calls actually almost childish. But at the same time, he asked the question, how is it that such childish notions penetrated deep philosophies like Buddhism and Hinduism? Well, then he gives a beautiful explanation, saying that perhaps both these ideas of afterlife and of rebirth as fields of punishment and reward were needed because suited to our half-mentalized animality. Because humanity itself is not much developed, and in its kindergarten level perhaps, you have to give to humanity such simple lollipops, you know, of reward and punishment. So he says, maybe when humanity was or is, or some people are still there in that level of half-mentalized humanity, animality, such notions are still perhaps helpful to guide them in this life. But then he says, when humanity becomes more intellectual, all these notions change, and in fact he says, the reward and punishment theory of rebirth comes to be ineffective. And then he goes now on a deeper level, which I suppose is now the next two paragraphs that we are going to take up, are in fact the real true spiritual foundations of this philosophy of rebirth. So what all we know about rebirth are more or less moral attitudes and more or less meant for an undeveloped humanity. Now it says the true foundation of the theory of rebirth is the evolution of the soul, or rather its efflorescence out of the veil of matter and its gradual self-finding. So this is in fact, as we have seen many times in the Life Divine and all the other chapters we have read, without this notion of the evolution of the soul, rebirth cannot be justified on any level. In fact, if you reject rebirth, it doesn't matter. If you do not believe in it, it doesn't matter. Because its entire necessity is only if we accept and if we believe in this, in the evolution of the soul. In fact, in other words, in somewhere else we have seen, it is the spiritual evolution of the soul that matters. You see, sometimes people may accept the notion of the soul, but if you don't accept the evolution of the soul itself, then rebirth has no status. It has no raison d'être at all. You can delete it completely. So the whole crux of rebirth is exactly synonymous almost with this phrase, spiritual evolution of the soul. So if we forget that argument, then I think we may forget all other things. So he would say, or rather its efflorescence out of the veil of matter and its gradual self-finding. You see, a magnificent explanation of what he means by evolution of the soul. Isn't the soul itself an aspect of the divine? then how does it evolve? What do we mean by the evolution? Because if we say the psychic being or the soul is an innate part of the divine, is a representative of the divine in man, then where is the question of its evolution? So again he explains the word evolution as efflorescence out of the veil of matter and its gradual self-finding. So when it leaps into matter, it forgets itself, its own reality. And therefore, it comes back to itself and says, here am I, this is my truth. So realization is nothing but finding out the truth of oneself. It is not realizing something that one is not. It is realizing one's own true innate nature. That's what we mean by self-finding, finding oneself. So this is the way that we understand the word rebirth is the evolution of the soul. Buddhism contained this truth involved in its theory of karma and emergence out of karma, but failed to bring it to light. Hinduism knew it of old, but afterwards missed the right balance of its expression. So you see, it's not just that we have come to believe this question of this moral attitude that we have seen. It's not that we don't know the truth. We know it, but you know, down the line, every religion, you know, comes down to kind of satisfy and to control the common man. So it kind of compromises with lots of non-spiritual things also. In fact, I would say unspiritual things, like the moral attitude and reward and punishment. But in the original thinking of Indian philosophy, we have the truth, and we will see at the end of the paragraph what the truth is. So he says, and unfortunately, it missed the right balance of its expression. Now we are again able to restate the ancient truth in a new language. And this is already being done by certain schools of thought, though still the old incrustations tend to tack themselves on to the deeper wisdom. And if this gradual efflorescence be true, then the theory of rebirth is an intellectual necessity, a logically unavoidable corollary. But what is the aim of that evolution? So we started the paragraph saying that it is rebirth is the evolution of the soul, and we have understood the meaning of the word evolution as efflorescence from matter towards its own higher self or real self. But then it says, if this gradual efflorescence be true, then the theory of rebirth is a logically unavoidable corollary. But what is the aim? Well, we said the aim is to come out of matter. Fine. Is to grow out of matter. It plunged into matter, forgot itself, and then it finds itself again through a whole process of thousands and thousands and thousands of births for different experiences, etc., etc. Now, when we say the word self-finding, well, that could be the aim, fine. The soul realizes that I am Brahman. That is why the Upanishad Soham, Aham Brahmasmi. These are the highest realizations, because that is the highest truth of oneself, that I am that Brahman, I am He. So you see, so it's, ultimately it is so simple, I am He. That is the whole truth of the whole thing, of this entire existence. But to come to that self-realization that I am the Brahman, I am He, it requires a whole million lives. Because so much is it got, has it got penetrated into matter, into the mesh of matter, that to unwrap itself from that mesh, it takes eonic time. And so he says, but is it, I mean, I'm trying to see how does it find out itself when we say, it says, I am he. How does it say? Is it just one layer is removed and suddenly you see all light and bright Brahmic consciousness? Or even, is there a growth towards that realization that I am he? Does it happen in a jiffy? In one life you come to a point and suddenly you say, I am he? It could happen. But before you came to that life, there has been a process. Now, what is that process? We need to understand how does that process take place of self-realization. And this para here is of most crucial importance, where it says, not conventional or interested virtue and the faultless counting out of the small coin of good in the hope of an apportioned material reward, but the continual growth of a divine knowledge, strength, love and purity. This is the process of self-realization. There is a continuity of divine knowledge, strength, love and purity, and you see the four different aspects. It's very interesting to see what these aspects are. Are they these four aspects of the mother, what we say Maheshwari, etc.? They could be closely related to that. But let's not bring these divine aspects. But he says, it is a continual growth into. So in one life, through many lives, it could be begetting divine knowledge. In certain lives, it could be begetting divine strength. In other lives, divine love. And all through perhaps the necessity of purification, what we call rejection and purification. Because without this basic purification, none of the other three things can be obtained. Neither knowledge, nor love, nor strength. So he says, these are the things that we continually get. Well, let's not demarcate saying that this life is knowledge, next life is knowledge and love and next life is strength. It could be a combination of any one of them. But basically, these are the characteristics. Now, if you link it with Gita, now you see the same question of Rajasic and Tamasic and Sattvic, etc. So there are these truths which are the eternal truths and which can be linked up with this process of self-finding. And I'm going further. These things alone are real virtue, and this virtue is own reward. So the fundamental meaning of rebirth is not to go for some reward. Because the moment we say reward, it's got to be something happy, something good, even something, at least for us, a reward is mostly material. If we do not get our material things, we do not think it to be a reward. If somebody is given a mental peace and inner joy, the moment you say Ma and you have the elan of this, you know, the great vibration of the psychic being, you won't ask for that. You think, no Ma, give me the other thing, give me that success, give me that. When you get that success, you think it's a reward. But when you saw a sunlight and then this is the first sun rays and you just thought of the Ma, isn't that also a great reward? We don't think. We think only in relation to material things. But these are all the great things. So Sri Aurobindo is telling, don't look for the small coin of good. You see, he calls the goodness a small coin in relation to what you are supposed to get of knowledge and love and strength, etc. Now this is the skeleton sentence here. These things alone are real virtue, and this virtue is its own reward. Ultimately, all values really are, you know, they're all, they can all be traced into this single phrase, that this virtue is its own reward. Now, if we keep this, this is the essential spirituality. I mean, there's no question of religion, religious virtues, religious ceremonies, all that have no place if you remember just one word, that this virtue is its own reward. And what is this virtue? We have seen the four, but he'll explain further. The one true reward of the works of love is to grow ever in capacity and delight of love up to the ecstasy of the spirit's all-seizing embrace and universal passion. So you see, you love the divine, you have this works of love. When we say we surrender to the mother, we work for the mother. There's no other reward that we should be counting for, except the delight of love increases to the extent that we have the ecstasy of the spirit's all-seizing embrace. I mean, that God's embrace is the ultimate of the works of love. So you work for the divine, you work for the mother, you work for Sri Aurobindo, you work for your own deity, not because God will bestow upon you and success and, you know, we go to this temple and that temple and say, God, I want this, I'll give you this. All, there's nothing called works of love. That's where religion doesn't come into the penumbra of such a thought even. Because religion always demands material benefits. But here you see, so beautiful that you work for the divine only one day, at one time, you get this all-seizing embrace and ecstasy of the spirit's all-seizing embrace. And I can vouch it, this is what Champaglaji got. In the last moments, or in the last days, if not the last moments, it seems Champaglaji was standing at the feet of Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo was lying supine on his bed. And suddenly, quite out of the blue, he got up. Sri Aurobindo got up. Champaglaji was standing there. And he embraced him. That is the works of love. For 25 years, a man did not know about himself. What existed was only Sri Aurobindo and Amma. So you can see this, how this works of love manifested literally in an embrace of the divine. How else could have Sri Aurobindo? I mean, to use the word reward is so stupid. I mean, what we say, tuchha. Sri Aurobindo's embrace is not a reward. It's the highest experience of the works of love. And we have a solid instance in Champaglaji. There are artist's impression of Champaglaji being embraced by Sri Aurobindo, but those are artist's impressions. But we have read the fact was not like that. It is actually, he was standing at the feet of Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo just gets up and goes and embraces. So this is a marvelous sentence. When I read that, I deeply remembered what Sri Aurobindo did. So that is really the ecstasy of the spirit's all-seizing embrace and universal passion. The one reward of the works of the right knowledge is to grow perpetually into the infinite light. What is the meaning of knowledge? To grow perpetually into light. Not to gain power. Not to think that I am all knowledgeable. Because all knowledge ultimately melts into light. Because afterwards, after the level, there are no words, there are no sentences, there is no thought. When you go beyond all that, what remains is pure light. So when knowledge translates itself into light, that is the highest reward, so-called, if at all we want to use the word reward. So that is when form conceived by thought leads you to the formless, the light, the power. Where light and power will always go together. So that is the process. So now let me read one more sentence. Then it says, the one reward of the works of right power is to harbor more and more of the force divine and of the work, the third one. So the third one, when we said about strength, works of right power, the whole thing is to harbor more and more the force divine. That means you keep working for the divine and then you harbor it. That means you become a vehicle, a vessel of divine force, where you become the instrument, the channel of the divine's working. And the last one, and the works of purity to be freed more and more from egoism into that immaculate whiteness where all things are transformed and reconciled into the divine equality. You see, the last one, what's the meaning of purity and purification? It is to lose one's ego. I mean, as long as there is any iota of ego, there can be, you can see there is a whole ocean of impurity. So this question of purity is to be freed more and more from egoism and what? And go into that immaculate whiteness where all things are transformed and reconciled into the divine equality. So once you become egoless, and it's not a question of once. You know, these words once, they are very meaningless words. Because nothing happens once and at a jiffy. It's all a process. It happens over life and over life. But when one comes to that egolessness, what happens is, it gives a description that you become that immaculate whiteness, the whiteness of the universality. And then you acquire that divine equality. So being in ego, you can never be equal. You can never have equanimity or equality. Because these are things of consciousness, the widening of the consciousness. So when Sri Aurobindo speaks of integral yoga as one of the basic things is samatha, equality. So you can see behind that word equality what is impregnated, the question of egolessness. It is not in the sense of the Gita, where, of course, the Gita also means the same, because you cannot achieve equanimity of the Gita by living or while living in ego. So these four are, I think, the essence of spirituality, of spiritual life, not spirituality as a theory. So this is where you see all these questions of rebirth and these theories and this ceremonies have no meaning at all. They cannot be approached at all. But then what happens? This is again the basis of all life is yoga. If you want to understand the sentence, here is the explanation. That at every moment we are working for laboring for knowledge, we are laboring to be the divine instrument, we are trying to purify. So this is how the process begins and then it can go on for lives together. And what Sri Krishna told us, that all spiritual effort, whenever and wherever you start, that is one thing that continues to happen. All other things of my success and of my money and of my wealth, everything vanishes with my last moments and in my grave. But it's only one thing that the spiritual effort continues. So you can see what we carry, so-called, to the next life. is only the spiritual effort. That is why now understand why Sri Aurobindo calls it all life is yoga. If it's done as yoga, then it is a perennial and an eternal yoga. And you can reach to those heights of divinity. To seek other reward is to bind oneself to a foolishness and a childish ignorance. And to regard even these things as a reward is an unripeness and an imperfection. So you see, in life, the moment you say, I want to achieve reward, that itself shows our level of consciousness. But when virtue becomes its own reward, then this question of honesty, purity, sincerity, no question of working for a boss, trying to please somebody else, nothing of that matters. Because at every moment my thought, my feeling is my own reward. I mean, it's such an immaculate explanation. I mean, I don't think, not that I've read much, but this is the fundamental truth of rebirth, of the evolution of the soul, of the process of the evolution of the soul, and ultimately, I may even like to link it with that phrase, all life is yoga. And what of suffering and happiness? Those are the four virtues we have said. Now, and what of suffering and happiness, misfortune and prosperity? Because these are the things that we always ask for, something good, something prosperity, some success. These are experiences of the soul in its training. Helps, props, means, disciplines, tests, ordeals, and prosperity often a worse ordeal than suffering. You see, he has, blasted all ideas of rebirth and award and reward. Sometimes prosperity could be the worst ordeal. It's worse than suffering. For what? For the soul. Outwardly you may have all the palace and all the kingly things around you, but you do not know how much your soul may be suffering. So we cannot count happiness related to only material prosperity. Whereas he says all these are disciplines, means, props for the growth of the soul. So there's only one line that seems to be growing through all this process, that is the evolution of the soul. All this may be sometimes, this audience may be a shortcut, an intense shortcut for the soul to reach higher levels of consciousness. So you see, our understanding is so fallow, our normal understanding of rebirth. To indeed, adversity, suffering may often be regarded rather as a reward to virtue than as a punishment for sin, since it turns out to be the greatest help and purifier of the soul struggling to find, to unfold itself. To regard it merely as a stern award of a judge, the anger of an irritated ruler, or even the mechanical recoil of result of evil upon cause of evil, is to take the most superficial view possible of God's dealings with the soul and the law of its evolution. You see, all that we have been talking about is a most superficial view. That means we have hardly an understanding of God's ways. Of course, we could never have had it not been for Sri Aurobindo who revealed what are God's intentions and ways. So this is, he says, all this punishment, etc., may be really something much more useful to the soul's evolution than what we normally think it to be. And what of worldly prosperity, wealth, progeny, the outward enjoyment of art, beauty, power? Good, if they be achieved without loss to the soul, and enjoyed only as the outflowing of the divine joy and grace upon our material existence. But let us seek them first for others, or rather for all, and for ourselves only as a part of the universal condition or as one means of bringing perfection nearer. I mean, these two paragraphs are really mantric. So powerful are they. So clear, so wonderful. He says, all this question of prosperity, wealth, progeny, they'll be good if they are achieved without loss to the soul. You see, this question of beauty, power, art, music, all that is good, but not at the cost of the growth of the soul. And many of you may know and remember, in those early days when, you know, there were great literata, great poets and great artists and great musicians in the ashram, and people thought, wow, they have got a shortcut to yoga, but sure, they would say no. If this art and music and all this, they are an outflowing of the divine joy and grace, is good, is an expression of your love for the divine, but not an expression of your love of your own ego. You want to put exhibits, you want to give this thing, your ego is being nourished by all that. He says no. So they impede the growth of the soul. So he says they must be only portions, parts for the expression and the advancement of your own soul. So now we understand why Sri Aurobindo did not encourage people to become full-time artists or full-time musicians or full-time poets. Because, you know, these artists can really get into themselves, into their own beautiful little world of egoism, where they don't see the others, where they don't get to know the world, and they become almost a beautiful ego, self-centered ego. And look at the last sentence. Let us seek them first. Seek them means prosperity, wealth, progeny, outward enjoyment, all that. Let us seek them first for others, or rather for all, and for ourselves only as a part of the universal condition, or as one means of bringing perfection nearer. So if you really launch on some work where you are doing perfection for the community, then as part, as a member of that community, you have the right to share. But not earning all that wealth and wealth for my sake, and what is surplus to me, give it to others. You see, the whole theme and theory of a collective living. I mean, no communism, nothing can come nearer to that. You see, this is a complete collective basis of life. And that is where spirituality comes in as the basis of a collective life. Everything for the others, for all, and I get only because I am a member of that all. So that is true spiritual collective living. The soul needs no proof of its rebirth any more than it needs proof of its immortality. For there comes a time when it is consciously immortal, aware of itself in its eternal and immutable essence. Once that realization is accomplished, all intellectual questionings for and against the immortality of the soul fall away like a vain clamor of ignorance around the self-evident and ever-present truth. That is the true dynamic belief. There's a Sanskrit phrase there. Tato na viskit sate. That is the true dynamic belief in immortality. When it becomes to us not an intellectual dogma, but a fact, as evident as a physical fact of our breathing, and as little in need of proof or argument. Well, we have understood in the last concluding paragraph of this chapter, he would say, once that realization is accomplished, that is when the soul finds itself. When the soul finds itself, what is that experience? I am the immortal. I am in fact immortality. So once the soul gets its own knowledge, then the rest becomes, you know, it falls away, as Swaminarayan writes here, falls away like a vain clamor of ignorance around self-evident and ever-present truth. So also there comes a time when the soul becomes aware of itself in its eternal and mutable movement. It is then aware of the ages behind that constituted the present organization of the movement. Sees how this was prepared in an uninterrupted past. Remembers the bygone soul states, environments, particular forms of activity which built up its present constituents and knows to what it is moving by development in an uninterrupted future. This is the true dynamic belief in rebirth. And there too the play of the questioning intellect ceases. The soul's vision and the soul's memory are all. Because you have seen, there are these two states, you know. One is when the soul realizes its own immortality, then all these questions of intellectual dogma, is there a rebirth or not, it matters not, it matters little. Because when it says, I am the immortal, then are you trying to ask the soul that, are you immortal, are you divine? It will not answer. These are all mental questions. But interestingly, it says, then it is aware of the ages behind that constituted the present organization of the movement. You see, when the soul reaches that state of self-finding, that is also the moment when it realizes all its past births, when it can kind of retrace in memory all this, is how this was prepared in an uninterrupted past, remembers the bygone soul states. So that is the moment when all those past lives come as a flash. Not because of the beauty of the, is not enamored of the past lives, but it can recover those lives in which it has taken advancement. There could be some lives where the advancement has not been as much as it was expected to be. So it would say, remember the bygone soul states, particular forms of activity which built up its present constituents. It's not a particular name and form and place. I think what shines in his memory are those events which run across space and time. It may not even remember the name and the form and the place, not at all. But say in the birth as Anand Reddy, there's nothing it has gained except it saw the mother face to face and bowed down to the mother. That perhaps is the only memory my soul would carry in its eternity. Rest is all meaningless. Rest is all dust and meaningless void. So such are these moments of divinity, a divine advancement, which it will carry. And he says, particular forms of activity which built up its present constituents and knows to what it is moving by development in an uninterrupted future. This is the true dynamic belief in rebirth, and there too the play of the questioning intellect ceases. The soul's vision and the soul's memory are all. Certainly, there remains the question of the mechanism of the development and of the laws of rebirth, where the intellect and its inquiries and generalizations can still have some play. And here, the more one thinks and experiences, the more the ordinary, simple, cut and dried account of reincarnation seems to be of doubtful validity. There is surely here a greater complexity, a law evolved with a more difficult movement and a more intricate harmony out of the possibilities of the infinite. But this is a question which demands long and ample consideration. For subtle is the law of it, anurbhaishya dharma. Well, of course, in fact, the last line is what he's going to explain, take up in the next chapter called the Reincarnating Soul, that for the sake of there remain the questions of the mechanism of the development and the laws of rebirth. You see, now we have got the kind of the quintessential movement of the soul towards its own self-finding. But then he wants to find out what exactly the mechanism of the development and the laws of rebirth. So he's going to go, there are about 3-4 more chapters where he goes deeper into the question of the mechanisms. How does, you know, we have already seen into this question of once the body is left behind, what are the different levels it goes through and how does it come back, what is the mechanism of returning, does the soul always go back to its Anandaloka or does it come back from the physical level or the vital level? All these questions we have already seen in the Life Divine and the other chapters. So here we come to the end of this chapter on this rebirth.